Chapter 12, The Hermitage. The Hermitage was situated at a bend of the road, a few hundred yards short of Ninth Mile. I must have passed it more than once, but could not remember having noticed it before. This was not surprising, since it stood well back from the road, and on looking up, all one saw against the hillside was a small wooden bungalow that had evidently known better days. It had not always been called the Hermitage. What it was originally called, I do not know, but it had been built 20 years earlier by an Englishman, probably a missionary or a retired army officer, and had been untenanted for some time. Joe had come to know about it through Kaka Bahadur, who had heard about it from his father, who had heard about it from his Hindu Niwa mistress and her half-Sikkimese son, to whom it jointly belonged. It had first been offered to Joe himself, but since he did not like the place, he had suggested it might do for me and the YMBA. So far as I was concerned, it would more than do. In fact, I fell in love with the place as soon as I saw it. Joe therefore discussed the question of rent with Mrs. Bishnumaya Pradhan and her son Tashi Tsering, who were so delighted with the idea of their bungalow being occupied by the English Buddhist monk who had recently organised the reception of the sacred relics, that they declared themselves happy to take only 65 rupees a month. They also declared that they intended to rename the bungalow in my honour. In future, it would be known as the Hermitage. Like so many other buildings in Kalimpong, the bungalow, into which I moved at the beginning of June, stood on a narrow ledge that had been cut out of the hillside. In this case, the ledge was rather broader than usual, and was bounded at each end by a jora, or ravine, in which grew clumps of bamboos. The hermitage was situated at one end of the ledge, the one that was nearer the town, while at the other end stood an octagonal summer house. Between the hermitage and the summer house, as well as all the way along the front of the property, was an extensive garden, or what had once been a garden, in which grew a variety of fine ornamental trees. There were magnolias and tulip trees, besides camellias and chocolate palms, and a number of other trees, whose names I did not yet know. There was also an ornamental pond in front of the summer house, circular in shape and surrounded by a parapet. The hermitage itself was a simple frame building with a corrugated iron roof that had once been painted red. What colour the walls had been painted it was difficult to tell, for the paint had peeled off long ago, both inside and outside. Moreover, many of the boards that comprised the exterior walls of the bungalow had warped and shrunk to such an extent that light penetrated through the chinks into the rooms. There were also cracks between the floorboards, through which one could see the bare earth only a few inches below. Despite its semi-derelict condition, however, I was delighted with the place. It seemed to suit our requirements exactly. No sooner had the question of rent been settled, therefore, than the YMBA moved in from Banshee's Godown, and I moved in from Bamaraja's guest cottage. There were 5 rooms, 3 of which opened directly onto the veranda, which was scarcely big enough to accommodate 3 chairs. In the middle one of these 3, which extended from the veranda to the back of the house, we installed our ping-pong table, which filled practically the entire room, leaving only a narrow gap on either side and barely space enough at each end for the players. The front room on the left, which contained a plank bed, a rickety gate-legged table and a kind of settle, became my bedroom and study, while the corresponding room on the right, which contained a small cabinet which had once been glass-fronted, became our library and reading room. The 2 smaller rooms at the back were reserved for guests. As for the summer house at the far end of the garden, which, unlike the hermitage, was a paka building, that is to say, constructed of reinforced concrete, this naturally became the shrine room. Here I pinned up my Tibetan colour print of the Buddha, which, apart from the miniature stupa, was still the only religious object I possessed. And here I performed my devotions each morning and evening, and meditated. Before many days had passed, I had settled in and was following much the same routine as I had followed before my departure from the Dharmadaya Vihara. I did not, however, go for alms gathering each morning. Gopal had moved to the hermitage with me and continued to do the cooking and shopping, though he was more painfully slow than ever, and it was becoming obvious that I would soon have to start looking for a new cook-bearer. Meanwhile, I had no alternative but to be patient with the old one and to get on with my work as best I could, despite late breakfasts and even later lunches. As before, my day was divided into two approximately equal parts. The morning and early afternoon was taken up with my Buddhist studies and with literary work, including the work of editing and publishing Stepping Stones, bundles of back issues of which were stacked on the floor of the library and reading room, while the late afternoon and early evening was devoted to giving individual tuition in various school and college subjects, as well as to developing my friendship with Sachin, Dawa, Padam, Lachuman, Jungi, and the other more regular members of the YMBA, all of whom were soon dropping in for a chat with me, or a game of ping-pong with one another, or even for a quiet browse through the Buddhist magazines we were receiving in exchange for stepping stones, almost every evening of the week. By the time the next full moon day came round, therefore, YMBA activities were flourishing even more vigorously at the hermitage than they had done at Banshee's Godown, so that when we crowded into the shrine room for our inaugural puja, there was a sense of elation in the air. Our members were happy that we had more attractive premises and that I was more easily accessible than I had been for a long time. I was happy that the YMBA and I were back under one roof and that we had a place which could, I hoped, be developed into a spiritual centre, the influence of which would be felt not only in Kalimpong but far afield. But there was one thing about which I was not happy. Though glad to have moved into the hermitage, I was not happy that my departure from Burma Raja's guest cottage should have upset Burma Raja and the princess as much as it had done. On the morning of my departure, they had invited me up to Panorama for a farewell meal. After taking the refuges and precepts, they offered the various dishes one by one in the traditional manner, and I spoke a few words about the Dharma. Then, when I had finished eating and had chanted the usual verses of blessing, the princess offered me some packets of gold leaf, and Burma Raja his big 4-volume Webster's New International Dictionary of the English Language, 2nd edition. I knew this dictionary very well, having frequently had occasion to consult it during the last 6 months. I also knew that it would be difficult for Burma Raja to manage without it, since he was a keen solver of crossword puzzles, and consulted the dictionary even more often than I did. But it was impossible to refuse the gift. It was also impossible to thank Burma Raja for it, that not being the Burmese Buddhist custom on such occasions. I therefore accepted the dictionary in silence, but I was deeply moved, and Burma Raja was moved too. Throughout the meal, which they did not, of course, share with me, both Burma Raja and the princess had in fact been strangely silent, and Burma Raja had more than once wiped his eyes with the back of his sleeve. When I rose to go, they both wept openly. For my part, though as a bhikshu I was not expected to show any emotion, or even to feel any, I could not help a lump forming in my throat and tears coming into my eyes when I thought how much I owed to Burma Raja and the princess. Despite their own troubles, they had taken me in when I was in difficulties and had nowhere else to go. They had looked after me, they had treated me like a son, and I would be grateful to them for as long as I lived. Though the farewell meal had further strengthened the bond between us, the fact that I was no longer living at the guest's cottage naturally meant that I saw much less of Burma Raja and the princess than before. It also meant that I saw much less of Mrs. Mitter and Mrs. Tagore and my other neighbours in that part of the development area. But if I saw less of my old neighbours, I made up for it by making contact with the new neighbours that I had acquired by moving to the Hermitage. My nearest neighbour was Mrs. Hamilton, who lived at Glengarry, on the opposite side of the road from the Hermitage. Since Glengarry was situated as much below the road as the Hermitage was above it, all I could see of the place was a strip of red-tiled roof that showed above the tall, neatly trimmed hedge. On the first few occasions that I encountered the grim-faced, grey-haired old woman standing at her front gate or toiling up the road, she ignored me completely. Subsequently, she glared at me through her spectacles. Then she gave me a very distant nod, and finally she bestowed on me a frosty good morning. After that we got on extremely well. She showed me round her very English garden, where I saw a very un-English crate wriggling along between the pansies and petunias, and actually invited me into her very English bungalow for a very English tea. The contrast between the interior of Glengarry and the interior of the Hermitage could hardly have been more striking. I might have been in a drawing room in the home counties, except for the hovering Nepalese bearer and the ayah, not to mention the Mali or gardener who came in with a bunch of roses for me to take back to the Hermitage with me. After that, I used to go down to Glengarry for my elevenses, which suited me better than afternoon tea. At least once every 2 or 3 weeks, and in her grim way, Mrs. Hamilton always seemed pleased to see me. Though she was not exactly communicative, I gathered that she lived alone, the 5 servants did not count, of course, that she was 73 years of age, and that she had a daughter in the UK High Commission in New Delhi, and a son in the Pakistan Air Force. I also gathered that she had very decided views on the subject of servants, who were apparently getting more unreliable every year. Servants should be seen but not heard. They should know their place. Though one should, of course, always treat them fairly, one should never permit the slightest familiarity, or indeed allow one's relationship with them to be anything other than that of master or mistress and servant. In particular, one should never accept anything from servants, by which she meant never accept the sweetmeats that Hindu servants were accustomed to offer their employers on the occasion of certain religious festivals. She never accepted anything from them. She refused to even touch what they brought, or even to allow it inside the house. If a servant of hers ever brought her anything, she ordered them to give it to the beggars immediately. Accepting things from servants could prove disastrous. It placed one under an obligation to them, and if one allowed that to happen, they would be sure to take advantage of it sooner or later. But if Mrs. Hamilton had very decided views on the subject of servants, she also had no less decided views on the subject of their employers, especially if these happened to be Bengalis. I was walking with her in her garden one day and admiring the flowers when Mrs. Mitter's elderly Nepalese gardener, the same man who had brought me the curries and sweetmeats when I lived at the guest cottage, and was still in the Queen of Kalimpong's good books, came with a bundle of seedlings. They were for Mitter Memsahib, he explained, salaaming. Mrs. Hamilton glared at him. "She is not Mitter Memsahib," she said sternly. "She is Mitter Babuni." Memsahib was, of course, the term of respect used of a European married woman, and although some of the more westernized Bengalis consider themselves to have succeeded to the social position formerly occupied by the British, people like Mrs. Hamilton were not prepared to let them get away with such presumption. Not that she herself was really British. From her complexion, which was almost as dark as Mrs. Mitter's, and much darker than Mrs. Tagore's, her accent, and the fact that she appeared to have no memories of Britain, it was evident that Mrs. Hamilton was in fact an Anglo-Indian, a person of mixed British and Indian descent, and most likely had never set eyes on the country to which she considered herself as belonging, and with whose manners and customs she so strongly identified. But although it was evident that Mrs. Hamilton was an Anglo-Indian, I knew that there was no question of my ever alluding to the fact, much less still asking her about it. For most Anglo-Indians, the subject of their racial provenance was an extremely delicate one, and many of them still regarded it as a deadly insult to be treated as anything other than 100% British in every respect. Another delicate subject was that of religion. Being British, Mrs. Hamilton was naturally a member of the Church of England. But since there was no Anglican church in Kalimpong, which was divided fairly equally between the Church of Scotland Mission up near 10th Mile and beyond, and the Roman Catholic Mission down at 7th Mile, she was dependent on the ministrations of the Anglican clergyman who came over from Darjeeling once every 2 or 3 months to take tea with and give Holy Communion to the town's 4 or 5 Anglican inhabitants. "He was a very nice man," Mrs. Hamilton assured me. "He never talked about religion." This information she imparted to me quite early on in our acquaintance, from which I gathered that her views on the subject of religion were no less decided than her views on the subject of servants and on that of their uppity Bengali employers. Religion was something that nice people never talked about. The message was clear. If I wanted her to think me a nice man, the subject of religion must never be mentioned between us. She would ignore the fact that I was a Buddhist, or whatever it was, and that I wore those strange yellow robes. We would talk about other things, like the growing unreliability of servants. Since I took the hint and never spoke about religion, she must have thought me a nice man. All the Anglicans in Kalimpong, in fact, must have thought me a nice man, even though the Presbyterians and Catholics did not. At any rate, that other nice man, the Anglican clergyman from Darjeeling, came to see me not long afterwards. On this occasion he was not staying at Glengarry, he explained, as he usually did, but at the blind school. He had heard quite a lot about me. Before he had set out from the blind school, however, he added with a smile, Auntie Mary had warned him about me. "Be very careful of that English Buddhist monk," she had said. "He can be very charming." Since we were both nice people and inclined to be ecumenical, the elderly Anglican clergyman and I laughed heartily at this little joke at Auntie Mary's expense. Not all my new neighbours were of the opinion that religion was something nice people never talked about. Mrs. Crisp, for instance, talked about it a lot, and in fact seemed to have quite an interest in the subject. She had changed her religion 17 times, she told me airily. She had been a Roman Catholic, a Muslim, a Christian Scientist, and a lot of other things. She had even been a follower of the Ramakrishna Mission, although so far, she added thoughtfully, she had not been a Buddhist. Not that she had any intention of becoming one, of course. At present, she and her son Esmond were Seventh-day Adventists, and she really believed she had at last found what she was looking for. How I came to know Flossie Crisp, I no longer recollect. A short, plump, rather pig-faced woman of about 50, with an abundance of greasy brown hair. She lived up the road from Mrs. Hamilton in a tiny cottage situated a short distance down the hillside, and in her usual unceremonious fashion must have accosted me on my way to or from the bazaar. Mrs. Hamilton probably would not have thought her a nice person at all. Not only did she talk quite freely about religion, but she wore shabby old dresses with down-at-heel shoes and was obviously poorer than it was proper for a European to be in India. But Flossie Crisp did not care. She was an artist, she assured me in her rich Irish brogue, over a cup of tea at the Hermitage. She had painted hundreds of pictures. In fact, Mother was an ARA, wasn't she, Esmond? Oh, yes, her son responded eagerly. Mother was an ARA, all right. Flossie Crisp's accounts of herself and her doings were apt to be punctuated in this way by appeals to Esmond for confirmation. Confirmation that was invariably forthcoming and constituted her son's only contribution to the conversation, except for an occasional boyish remark. Tall and stooping, he wore a grey flannel suit that he had long outgrown, and from which his arms and legs protruded to a painful extent, together with an unpressed shirt, collar and tie. He was also completely bald. How old he was, it was difficult to tell, probably between 25 and 30. Eventually it dawned on me that Esmond was, in fact, mentally retarded, and that his mental age was probably not more than 12. But this was another delicate question, and I could no more ask Mrs. Crisp about it than I could ask Mrs. Hamilton if she was an Anglo-Indian, though the former did once volunteer the information that poor old Esmond was not very bright and had experienced difficulty finding a job. It also eventually dawned on me that even if Flossie Crisp was not Irish, for in the end I even doubted the genuineness of her rich Irish brogue, she must certainly have kissed the Blarney Stone, not once, but 100 times. Nonetheless, she was cheerful, good-natured, and amusing. Her habit of romancing about herself and her doings did no harm to anyone, except perhaps the romancer, and I was always glad to see her and Esmond at the Hermitage, and glad to have tea with them sometimes in the homely living room of their cottage. On one of these latter occasions, she talked at length about the tiny Adventist mission down near Seventh Mile, of which she and Esmond were members, and about the elderly Dutch couple who were now running it. The Jansens, I gathered, were not nearly such nice people as their youthful American predecessors, whom I had myself met shortly after my arrival in Kalimpong, and whom I had found much friendlier than any of the missionaries there. The Jansens just wanted to make life difficult for everybody. Though she and Esmond attended services every week, Mrs. Crisp complained with some bitterness, the Jansens were forever criticising them and accusing them of backsliding. In particular, they were forever criticising them for drinking tea. As I knew from my contact with the Jansens' American predecessors, the Seventh-day Adventists prohibited stimulants of every kind. Nor was this all. When she had asked Mr. Jansen what she should drink instead of tea, he had replied, "Drink Ovaltine, Mrs. Crisp, drink Ovaltine." She had nearly exploded. Did I know how much a tin of Ovaltine cost in a place like Kalimpong? I didn't. Well, it cost far more than she and Esmond could afford. It was easy enough for Mr. Jansen to talk. He and his wife received enormous food parcels from America every month and could drink as much Ovaltine as they liked without having to spend a pie. But no one sent food parcels to her and Esmond. They had to drink tea because that was all they could afford to drink. Anyway, even though she was a Seventh-day Adventist, she liked her cup of tea, she added defiantly, replenishing our cups. These brave words were hardly out of her mouth when there came a sudden loud knock at the door. Mrs. Crisp turned pale. "My God," she exclaimed in a terrified whisper, "it's the minister," and promptly hid the teapot. This incident gave me considerable food for thought, not only at the time, but long afterwards. It was a perfect illustration of the way in which people can be controlled through the imposition of more or less arbitrary taboos, the breaking of which gives rise to irrational feelings of guilt. If the taboo is of such a nature that it is almost certain to be broken, sooner or later, then the task of control is made much easier, for the power that imposes the taboo is also the power that absolves the breaker of the taboo from his feelings of irrational guilt, for a price. Drinking tea may not be very good for one's health, but it can hardly be considered a sin. Yet Mrs. Crisp had been made to feel that it was a sin, or something so very much like a sin that the difference hardly mattered. When she heard Mr. Jansen's knock, she had actually experienced fear, at least for a moment, fear of being caught breaking a taboo. And to the extent that he could make her feel fear, fear based upon guilt, the minister had her under his control. It was also interesting that Mr. Jansen had advised Mrs. Crisp to drink Ovaltine, which he could afford and she could not. Evidently, there were some taboos that could not be observed without money, and if they could not be observed without money, then only the rich could be virtuous. The rich were, in fact, the virtuous, just as the poor were the sinners. Wealth was virtue, poverty was vice, equations that Joe regarded as typically American. Typically American or not, they were equations with which at least one person whom I came to know at this time would have disagreed. This was Miss Rao. She was not a neighbour, and I came to know her not so much because I had moved to the Hermitage, as because I had organised the reception of the sacred relics, or rather, because I had accompanied them on their visit to Miss Sandup's flat in Chung Building. Like Mrs. Crisp, Miss Rao talked about religion with a freedom that would have horrified Mrs. Hamilton, though unlike Mrs. Crisp, she had never changed her religion. She had no need to. She was a Hindu and firmly believed that all religions were the same, because, as she was fond of explaining to her Buddhist and Christian friends, they were in fact nothing but different forms of Hinduism. Since Miss Rao lived in a flat on the second floor of Chung Building, it was therefore only natural that when the sacred relics were taken to Mrs. Sundup's flat on the third floor, Miss Rao should have been among the friends and neighbours who came and made offerings. It was also natural that she should have spoken to Sangharatana and myself, and still more natural that a few weeks later she should have invited me to have tea with her and her ailing mother, whom she very much wanted me to meet. Though the shabby and congested flat at the back of Chung Building, overlooking the Mela ground, bore little resemblance to Chitra Banu, Mrs. Rao herself was in certain respects the South Indian counterpart of Mrs. Tagore. Like Mrs. Tagore, she was a woman of great dignity and sweetness of character, who had evidently suffered much, and like Mrs. Tagore, she was rather emaciated. She was, however, not only considerably older than the high priestess of Shantiniketan, but also much more frail, though not as if recently recovered from a long illness, but as if slowly succumbing to its effects. She had, in fact, not much longer to live, and though I did not know this, it was obvious that the gentle, quietly spoken old Brahmin lady from Mysore was glad to be able to talk to someone about more serious matters, as well as to share her fears and anxieties with regard to her unmarried daughter and the unemployed son, whom I had not yet seen. As I listened to Mrs. Rao, I could not help thinking how little resemblance there was between her and Miss Rao. Mother and daughter were, in fact, exact opposites in almost every respect, and it was difficult to believe that they were related at all. One could only assume that Miss Rao resembled her father, who had died some years previously, and about whom she often spoke. Daddy had been the manager of a large and important bank. They had been extremely rich, and had moved in the highest social circles. She herself had been brought up with the daughters of the Maharaja of Mysore, and was in and out of the palace day and night. But Daddy had died, and they had lost all their wealth, or nearly all of it. They had been swindled. Banks in which they had deposited their money had failed. Now they were as poor as church mice. That was why they were having to live in a place like Chung Building and put up with a landlady like Mrs. Sandup. Oh yes, didn't I know? Mrs. Sandup was the owner of Chung Building. She had been married for a while to Mr. Chung, the Chinaman who had built the place, though that was a long time ago, and no one knew what had happened to Mr. Chung. But, as she was saying, now they were as poor as church mice, and she and her mother could hardly make both ends meet. She only wished I could have seen them in Mysore before Daddy's death, when I would have been astonished by their pomp and grandeur. Why, in those days, they had been simply rolling in wealth. This was a favourite phrase of Miss Rao's, and one with which she so often concluded her accounts of the past glories of the House of Rao, that I was eventually left with a mental picture of the whole Rao family actually rolling in enormous heaps of gold, kicking their heels in the air with delight as they did so. But although Mrs. Rao and her daughter were opposites in almost every respect, it was in personal appearance that they differed most strikingly. Whereas there was nothing in the least unusual about Mrs. Rao, Miss Rao presented a truly extraordinary sight. To begin with, she was hardly more than 4 feet tall, with a head that was a little too big for her body, and was invariably swathed in a gaudily coloured sari that was much too large for her. She was indeed the only Indian woman I had ever seen who did not wear a sari elegantly. On top of her sari, she wore a woollen cardigan, also gaudily coloured, while her head and shoulders were completely covered by a kind of wimple, a type of headscarf, from which there looked out a little black face with quick, darting, suspicious eyes and a large, sensual mouth. On special days, such as when Miss Rao came to see me at the Hermitage, the little black face would be thickly covered with white powder, which gave it a purplish tinge, and the large, sensual mouth liberally smeared with bright red lipstick. Miss Rao also wore a pair of brown plimsolls, and when she went out, her costume would be completed by a battered leather handbag, gloves that had split at the seams, various rings, brooches, necklaces, a knitted scarf or two, and, occasionally, an old fur boa. Cutting the fantastic figure that she did, it was hardly surprising that Miss Rao should be well known to quite a number of people in Kalimpong, at least by sight. It was also hardly surprising that she should be the subject of a certain amount of speculation. According to my students, the speculation centred on her wimple, which was held in position by hairpins, and which no one had ever seen her without. Some people were of the opinion that Miss Rao wore the wimple because she was bald, others that she wore it because her hair was, in fact, only a wig. A third school of thought, which was the one most favoured by the students themselves, maintained that Miss Rao wore the wimple because she had no ears. Which of these explanations was the right one, or whether they were all wrong and Miss Rao wore the wimple for an entirely different reason, it was really impossible to say. It was also impossible to ask Mrs. Rao herself to clear up the mystery, for it was obvious that here was yet another of those delicate questions I had already encountered with Mrs. Hamilton and Mrs. Crisp. Not that I was particularly concerned to know why Miss Rao wore a wimple. That was her own affair. But knowing, as I did, how upper-caste Hindus felt about any kind of physical blemish or defect, especially in a woman, I was well aware that life might have been made difficult for her in more ways than one. I therefore resolved that, even though there was something about Miss Rao that I found quite repulsive, I would go on seeing her and her mother and help them in whatever way I could. While I was making new friends, however, I was suddenly deprived of an old friend. One morning, Thubten Tenzing arrived at the Hermitage with the news that within the next few days he would be leaving Kalimpong and returning to England. Why he was leaving he did not say, and I did not ask, though I knew he was well settled in Kalimpong and had been looking forward to staying there indefinitely. It was only too evident that the whys and wherefores of his departure belonged with all the other delicate questions I had recently encountered in Kalimpong, and which seemed to crop up there with such frequency. In any case, from remarks that had been made by the long-lived Deva, I knew that the government of India was well aware that something was going on behind the scenes at Thubten Tenzing's bungalow, and that it was not very happy with what my universalist friend did when he disappeared down the tunnel that led from the back of his cave of treasures into the darkness. Like my own chance of accompanying the sacred relics to Tibet, Thubten Tenzing's continued stay in Kalimpong was being sacrificed along with the freedom and independence of Tibet on the altar of Sino-Indian friendship. The mysterious activities of which the tunnel was the venue were ultimately connected with the Tibetan resistance movement, and since this was a connection that the government of India was not prepared to tolerate, Thubten Tenzing had been asked to leave Kalimpong. I was sorry to see him go. Since the departure of the sacred relics, we had seen quite a lot of each other, and had paid several more visits to the Thapa Choling Gompa. On one of these visits, we had witnessed the ceremony of reconciliation between the two parties that, as I had heard from the long-lived Deva, had been formed among the monks some time previously, with such disastrous results. The ceremony took place in the grassy courtyard in the front of the monastery temple. Somewhat to my surprise, if not to Thubten Tenzing's, the 40 or 50 monks, headed by our old friend the abbot, all sat together on the bare ground, while the Tibetan government officials sat on richly carpeted chairs, something that would have been quite unthinkable in a Theravada Buddhist country. One of the officials read out a letter from the Dalai Lama, while ceremonial scarves were exchanged, and after the monks had been harangued at great length by Mr. Tharchin, who of course was a Christian, everybody filed into the temple for a puja. On another visit, we had the opportunity of meeting the Gyalmo Chenmo, or Great Royal Mother, that is to say, the mother of the Dalai Lama, who was staying a few weeks in Kalimpong before carrying on with her pilgrimage to Buddha Gaya. We met her in the abbot's room, a tall, stout woman of great natural dignity and evident kindliness. She was magnificently dressed in a chuba of Chinese silk brocade, and wore on her head a tall gold brocade cap with enormous projecting ear flaps lined with fur. Thubten Tenzing was thoroughly captivated by her, and afterwards spoke of her with tremendous enthusiasm. And indeed, she was all that one would expect the mother of a Dalai Lama to be. Apparently, Mr. Tharchin had also been captivated by her. According to Thubten Tenzing, he had come away from a meeting with her shaking his head and exclaiming, "What a wonderful woman! Just think, she is the mother of three incarnations." The great royal mother, having given birth not only to the Dalai Lama himself, but to two other sons who had also been recognized as incarnate lamas. Thubten Tenzing was inclined to think that Tharchin's outburst showed that he was at heart very much a Buddhist, but personally I found this difficult to believe. So far as I could see, the editor of the Tibet Mirror, though amiable enough, was a victim of chronic mental confusion, and did not really know where he stood. Before Thubten Tenzing left Kalimpong, we agreed to correspond, and he presented me with a Tibetan rug, a Bhutanese copper and brass jug, a silver coffee pot, and seven battered aluminium puja bowls. The Tibetan rug, which was predominantly dark blue in colour, was beginning to fray at the edges, but Thubten Tenzing explained that it was a rather special rug since it had been made for him in Gyantse before the war, and was the first one he had commissioned from the master rugmaker, with whose help he had subsequently tried to revive what was by that time a rapidly dying art. It was, of course, made of wool, and the dyes that had been used in its manufacture were all of natural origin. He also offered me a choice of tankers or painted scrolls. I could either have a set of three tankers depicting the Buddha with Shariputra and Modgalyayana and the 16 Arahants, the brocade mounts of which were badly torn, or a single tanker depicting the wrathful Vajrapani, which was in somewhat better condition. Though I was very much attracted to the figure of the wrathful Vajrapani, which indeed affected me in much the same way as the giant image of Padmasambhava I had seen in Kalimpong, on reflection I decided to take the set of three tankers instead. The wrathful Vajrapani, which means thunderbolt in hand, was, as I knew, a specifically tantric divinity, and pictorial representations of him were, like the pictorial representations of other such divinities, not works of art in the modern Western sense, but aids to the visualization of his flame-encircled and awe-inspiring form in meditation. Since I was not practicing this kind of meditation, which I was indeed not qualified to practice, not having received the appropriate tantric initiations, and since the tankers were in any case not to be treated simply as decorations, it did not seem right for me to have in my possession a tanker depicting the wrathful Vajrapani or any other specifically tantric divinity. The tankers depicting the Buddha with Shariputra and Modgalyayana and the 16 Arahants were another matter, representing as they did not tantric deities but historical personalities. The beautifully painted scrolls were not aids to visualization so much as an incitement to the living of the spiritual life in the widest sense, and as such they were well suited to my present needs. Beneath the benign gaze of the Buddha, who, flanked by his two chief disciples, occupied the upper half of the center scroll, the 16 shaven-headed, yellow-robed Arahants were travelling across the sea on the backs of all kinds of strange land and marine monsters. According to legend, they had been forced to leave Kashmir due to persecution and were now on their way to China to preach the Dharma to the people of that country. In choosing the tankers depicting the Buddha with Shariputra and Modgalyayana and the 16 Arahants, rather than the one depicting the wrathful Vajrapani, I was, of course, acting in accordance with Buddhist tradition, but there was at least one Western Buddhist in Kalimpong to whom tradition meant very little, and who had no qualms whatever about using tankers of tantric divinities as decorations or even for stranger purposes. Joe was by this time living at Tirupai with a well-to-do Sherpa family and visited the hermitage only occasionally, usually for the full moon day puja or when I gave a lecture. The first time he saw my newly acquired tankers, which I had hung on the wall beside my bed — the summer house shrine was too damp for them at that time of year — he turned away with a contemptuous sniff and a dismissive wave of the hand after only a cursory inspection. "I should have taken the other tanker," he declared irritably, with an air that suggested that in his usual headstrong fashion the youthful and inexperienced Sangharachita had once again done the wrong thing due to lack of proper advice and guidance. Anyone could see with half an eye that a single large figure would have looked better on the wall than a number of small ones. "Not that he cared what tanker I chose," he added sharply, glaring at me through his spectacles, as though I had accused him of such a weakness. "So far as he was concerned, I could choose what tankers I liked. But I should not think that I was the only one in Kalimpong who was acquiring tankers. He too had started acquiring them, though in his case, of course, there was no one to give them to him, much less still offer him a choice. If he wanted a tanker, he had to buy it himself. In fact, he had recently commissioned a small painted scroll from a Tibetan artist who lived at Tirupai. Next time I passed by on my way to the Gompa, I should drop in and have a look at it. It might broaden my outlook." On my next visit to the Tapa Choling Gompa, therefore, I made a point of calling on Joe at the downstairs flat he and Dil Bahadur occupied in Sherpa Building. The tanker he had commissioned was not mounted on brocade, but framed in Western style, It hung just inside the door of the flat, where it was most likely to catch the eye of the visitor. Like the single tanker that Thubten Tenzing had offered me, it depicted the wrathful Vajrapani, and it depicted him in much the same way. There was the same stout, dark blue body, naked except for a garland of skulls, the same aureole of flames, the same expression of terrific anger. The only difference was that Joe's Vajrapani was depicted with an erect penis. This, I knew, was a perfectly traditional way of representing the bodhisattva of power, and in fact a number of other wrathful, as distinct from peaceful, tantric deities as well. The erect penis symbolized the arisen or awakened bodhicitta, the aspiration to supreme enlightenment for the sake of all living beings. But from Joe's cackle of amusement as I stopped to look at the painting, it was clear that he had commissioned it not as a means of reminding himself about the bodhicitta, but rather in order to shock the unwary visitor. To him, the erect blue penis was simply an erect penis, and since erect penises of whatever colour were not usually depicted in art, the sight of the painting could be expected to have all sorts of interesting effects on people. What effect it had on me, apart from broadening my outlook, it would be difficult to say. Certainly I was not shocked, and Joe had to be satisfied with telling me, over a cup of tea, how extremely shocked some of his other visitors had been when they set eyes on his wrathful Vajrapani. A woman missionary from Dr. Graham's homes, who had seen it, had been so shocked that she actually screamed. As he told me the story, Joe crossed and uncrossed his legs and rocked himself backwards and forwards in his chair with undisguised glee. But though I could share his amusement at the missionary's reaction to the painting, at least to some extent, I was far from sympathising with his underlying attitude. The use to which he had put his wrathful Vajrapani represented a serious devaluation of the sexual symbolism of the tantras, not to say a degradation. Unfortunately, it was a devaluation that was to become increasingly common among Western Buddhists as the artistic expressions of that symbolism became more widely known. In Joe's case, the devaluation was obviously mixed up with all sorts of personal factors, the precise nature of which was a delicate question. I therefore confined myself to assuring him that, contrary to what his remarks at the hermitage had implied, I had started acquiring tankers only in the sense that I had not acquired any previously. How long it would be before I acquired others, I did not know. Tankers were extremely expensive, and I could certainly not think of commissioning a Tibetan artist to paint one for me as he had done. But if I had not started acquiring tankers, I had started acquiring religious objects of a more modest kind. I had started acquiring Tibetan woodblocks of the various Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and other divinities. Most of them were about 10 inches long and 8 inches wide, and less than an inch in thickness, and they were used for producing crude prints for the household shrines of those who were too poor to afford anything more elaborate. I had started acquiring them, even, it must be admitted, collecting them, partly because I was attracted by their very roughness and simplicity, and partly because I was not in a position to buy either images or tankers. I bought them from the same little Tibetan curio shop in Darjeeling, where, only 6 years earlier, when I was still in the army, I had bought a Mogul miniature painting to send to Claire Cameron, the enigmatic editor of The Middle Way, the quarterly journal of the London Buddhist Society. Though the ink-stained blocks cost no more than 7 or 8 rupees apiece, even this modest sum was often beyond my means, and I had to leave the shop without having bought anything. Not that the grey-haired Tibetan proprietor seemed to mind. He always greeted me with a bow and a warm smile when I entered his shop, and gave me a bow and an equally warm smile when I left. The reason why I was able to buy Tibetan woodblocks at Tashi Pemba's little shop in Mackenzie Road was that shortly before moving into the hermitage, I had started paying regular visits to Darjeeling. The purpose of these visits was not to add to my collection of woodblocks, however, or even to add to my collection of books. As a result of the reception that the town had given the sacred relics at the beginning of April, there had been in Darjeeling, as in Kangpong, a definite upsurge of interest in Buddhism, and I wanted to take advantage of this upsurge before it had time to subside. While the sacred relics were still in Darjeeling, I had in fact called a preliminary meeting of young Buddhists, that is, Buddhists under 40, to consider the possibility of opening a branch of the YMBA there. After I had briefly outlined the aims and objects of the association, it was unanimously resolved that a branch of the YMBA should be established in Darjeeling and that a second meeting should be held for the election of office bearers. At this second meeting, which took place 2 weeks later, I again outlined the aims and objects of the association, and a committee was elected with one of the ubiquitous Mr. Lamas as president and another as secretary. The committee then resolved that regular meetings should be held, if possible, every Sunday, and that efforts should be made to secure premises at an early date. On my next two visits to Darjeeling, which took place in June and August, I gave two public lectures on Buddhism at the Brahma Samaj Hall, as well as a lecture on the purpose of education at the Government College, with the Bengali principal of which I was soon on friendly terms. The two public lectures in particular aroused considerable interest. They were the first I had given in the town, and I suspected the first that had been given there on Buddhism for a very long time. At any rate, they were of sufficient rarity for the town's leading citizens to be there in force, from the Bengali deputy commissioner and his wife downwards. In the first lecture, I took a very broad view, and besides attempting to cover the whole field of Buddhism, surveyed its relation to the modern world in general, and India in particular. In the second lecture, confining myself to a more specific theme, I sought to elucidate the threefold significance of the term Dharma. Yet, despite these visits, and despite the undoubted success of my lectures, despite committee meetings and talks with the Mr. Lamas and other friends, the Darjeeling branch of the YMBA never succeeded in establishing itself in the way I had hoped. Not a single Sunday meeting was held, and no premises were ever secured. So long as I was actually there in Darjeeling and in personal contact with people, it was all right. There would be plenty of enthusiasm and many promises to organise this or that activity. But no sooner was I back in Kalimpong than everything would collapse like a house of cards until my next visit. Strange to say, it was much the same story in Gangtok. There too, a definite upsurge of interest in Buddhism had taken place as a result of the reception given to these sacred relics, and there too a branch of the YMBA had been formed with no less a person than the Crown Prince as president. The Crown Prince had, in fact, given the branch the use of a room in the bazaar. But after a few months, everything had collapsed in Gangtok too. The young Sikkimese, who had been appointed assistant secretary and who was effectively in charge, stopped replying to my letters, and I subsequently learned that he was generally too drunk to do either that or anything else. In these circumstances, I could not help wondering how long even the Kalimpong YMBA would survive if I was away for any length of time. Joe was fast losing interest, and our members were as yet too young and too inexperienced to be able to manage on their own. Sooner or later, I would have to give serious thought to the whole question of the future of our activities in the area. Giving lectures and attending committee meetings was not the only purpose of my visits to Darjeeling, however. Stepping Stones was now being printed not at the Mani Press, Kalimpong, but at the Mani Printing Press, Darjeeling. And though our new printers were not only cheaper than the old ones, but more efficient, I thought it best to see them personally from time to time. Unfortunately, in transferring our custom in this way, I had unwittingly become embroiled in a bitter family feud. The manipress had been started by three Hindu Newar brothers, all of whose personal names terminated in Mani, meaning jewel or pearl. After they had carried on the business together for a few years, a split had occurred between the two younger brothers and the oldest brother, and the former, after a particularly violent quarrel, had driven the eldest out and deprived him of his share of the business. Vowing revenge, this brother had moved to Darjeeling and founded the Mani Printing Press. Since he was a man of considerable energy, and moreover one who combined business acumen with literary talent, he had soon built the new press up into one of the leading printing and publishing houses in the district. Having done this, he had started systematically enticing his brother's customers away from them, and was now, by this means, steadily achieving his declared objective of driving them out of business. He had enticed his brother's customers away from them by the simple expedient of offering to do their work at the Calcutta rate, which was considerably less than the local rate, and the YMBA was one of those that had been so enticed. When they heard that they had lost our custom to their elder brother, and that stepping stones would in future be printed not in Kalimpong but in Darjeeling, the two brothers at the Mani Press were not only very dismayed, but even quite angry. But I soon pacified them, assuring them that there was no question of our being dissatisfied with their work. I told them frankly that the financial position of the YMBA was such that I had no alternative but to get our printing done as cheaply as I could. Since they had no difficulty in appreciating this, and since I settled their bill without too much delay, before many months had passed, friendly relations had been restored, though it was noticeable that the elder of the two brothers never treated me with quite the same cordiality as he had done in the days when Stepping Stones was being printed in Kalimpong. Compared with some of the other customers that the enterprising founder of the Mani Printing Press had succeeded in enticing away from his two brothers, the YMBA was of very little consequence. But Paras Mani Pradhan, as he was called, was pleased to be printing Stepping Stones all the same, and for reasons that were not entirely connected with the family feud. In the first issue that he had printed for us, there had appeared an announcement to the effect that from the following month a special Nepali section containing articles on Himalayan religion, culture and education, besides translations of the teachings of the Buddha, would be published in Stepping Stones every month. This was exactly the kind of project that Paras Mani Pradhan, as a zealous champion of Nepali language and literature, was most anxious to encourage. And besides printing our now bilingual magazine, he therefore also made sure that the Nepali section was up to standard from the literary point of view. We had started publishing this Nepali section for very definite reasons. Though Nepali was the lingua franca of the Darjeeling district, as well as the national language of Nepal, so far as I had been able to ascertain, there existed in Nepali not a single book on Buddhism and not a single Buddhist magazine. A deficiency as serious as this clearly had to be made good without delay, at least to a limited extent, for it was obvious that unless the millions of Nepali-speaking Buddhists were able to study the Buddha's teachings in their own language, there was little hope of their being able to understand and practice those teachings, and little hope that the YMBA or any other Buddhist organization would be able to make much headway among them. The expansion of Stepping Stones into a bilingual magazine naturally entailed a certain amount of extra work, and therefore a certain amount of reorganization. After some rather protracted discussions and negotiations, an editorial board had been set up consisting of myself as editor, Bai Chand Pradhan as assistant editor with special responsibility for the Nepali section, and Rudramani Pradhan and Sachindra Kumar Singh as members. Rudramani Pradhan was the public-spirited young civil engineer who had accosted me on my arms round more than a year earlier and who had arranged for me to give a lecture at Pudong. Though not one of our regular members, he came to see me from time to time, and I could always rely on his help in an emergency. As the eldest of Parasmani's 8 sons, the one who was not engaged in the printing and publishing trade, there were at least a few drops of printer's ink in his veins, despite the fact that he preferred inspecting roads to checking proofs, and he was glad to cooperate with us in our new undertaking. Bhaichand Pradhan was not a member of the YMBA at all. Sachin, Padam, and various other friends had more than once tried to persuade him to join, but hitherto he had always refused. So far as I could tell, this aloofness was due partly to the fact that he was 8 or 10 years older than the majority of our members, and had no wish to be seen associating with a pack of boys, and partly because he was afraid of falling under my influence and thus compromising his independence. In appearance, he was not only extremely tall, but so thin that the tight-fitting Nepali costume he invariably wore made him look positively skeletal. His face was long and cadaverous, with deep furrows down either side of the mouth. But his eyes were bright, and his expression was one of exceptional intelligence and good humour. Since he was an arts graduate, he had naturally gravitated to teaching, and in fact taught Nepali at the local government high school, which was situated next door to the Hermitage on the bazaar side, but hidden away behind so dense a screen of bamboos and so thick a mass of giant rhododendrons that I rarely heard any other sound than that of the school bell. Though not yet 30, Bhaichand Pradhan was already known as something of a litterateur, and much of his spare time was spent writing articles and poems for Nepali magazines and attending Nepali literary conferences. His companion in these pursuits was a small, meek-looking Nepali poetess called Sanumati Rai, whom he visited every evening at her home behind a vegetable shop in the high street, and with whom he was reputedly carrying on a highly platonic love affair. Love affair or no, his connections with the Nepali literary scene made Bhaichand Pradhan the obvious choice as editor of the Nepali section of Stepping Stones, and his name came up more and more frequently in our discussions. But how was the standoffish young litterateur to be persuaded to accept the position? In the end, Rudramani undertook to approach him, and with the help of a certain amount of cajolery, eventually succeeded in overcoming his resistance and inducing him to accept our invitation to join the editorial board of Stepping Stones. Bhaichand did not accept the invitation without laying down certain conditions, the chief of which was that he should not have to join the YMBA and not be expected to take part in any of its activities. On the whole, this arrangement worked quite well. Though he continued to be extremely wary of any personal contact, Bhaichand was a conscientious and reliable editor, and the Nepali section of Stepping Stones was soon well known to the Nepali-speaking Buddhists of the area. Despite the fact that it consisted of no more than 8 or 10 pages, it was quite varied in content. There were translations from the Pali Buddhist scriptures, articles on various aspects of Tibetan Buddhism, some of them translated from English, editorials, news items, and a generous sprinkling of poems by Sanumati Rai. Among the Pali Buddhist texts that I was most anxious to see translated into Nepali was the Dhammapada, and it was not long before excerpts from this celebrated scripture began appearing in the Nepali section of our little magazine. Space, however, was limited. Only half a dozen verses could be published in each issue, and I calculated that at this rate it would take us 7 or 8 years to bring out the entire work. This was much too long. Since Bhaichand was making good progress with the translation, I therefore decided that we would bring it out in book form together with the original Pali text without further delay. But from where were we to get the necessary funds? At least 2,000 rupees would be needed. We had no wealthy backers, and I already knew how difficult it was to collect donations for our work. In these circumstances, I bethought myself of the distinguished devotee and staunch supporter of the Mahabodhi Society, to whose flat on the third floor of the Chung building, Sangharatana and I had taken the sacred relics. Perhaps Mrs. Rose Sundup would help. I accordingly went to see her. She received me with much fluttering of eyelashes and a good deal of confusion at the honour I had done her by visiting her humble abode. And after we had talked about the sacred relics and she had offered me tea, I explained the purpose of my visit. The small, plump Tibetan woman was all sympathy and listened to me wide-eyed, her clasped hands pressed tightly to her bosom. How wonderful it would be to have the Dhammapada in Nepali. She would be able to read it herself at last. She had to admit that she was really rather naughty, she added, wriggling her broad hips. Though she was Tibetan, well, a Darjeeling-born Tibetan, she was unable to read or write Tibetan properly, and therefore could not study the Tibetan Buddhist scriptures. They were very difficult anyway, weren't they? It would be such a comfort to have the Dhammapada in Nepali. Of course she would help me. But 2,000 rupees was an awful lot of money. She was very poor and had all sorts of expenses to meet. Buildings had to be repaired. Tenants didn't pay their rent. Anyway, she would think about the matter and see what she could do. Would I mind coming again in 2 or 3 days' time? 2 or 3 days later, therefore, I again climbed the flights of dirty stone steps that led to Mrs. Sundup's flat. Again she received me with much fluttering of eyelashes, though this time with only a fair amount of modest confusion. And after she had given me tea, we had the same conversation, with minor variations, that we had had on my previous visit. In the course of the following month, this performance was repeated at least 5 or 6 times. In the course of the following month, this performance was repeated at least 5 or 6 more times. And I began to wonder if the distinguished devotee and staunch supporter of the Mahabodhi Society was really quite so sympathetic as she appeared. Perhaps in some ways I was rather young and inexperienced, not to say naive, as Joe had always maintained. Anyway, since she continued to ask me to come again in 2 or 3 days' time, I continued to climb the stairs of Chung Building, though I now did so at somewhat longer intervals, sometimes combining a visit to Mrs. Sundup on the third floor with a visit to Miss Rao and her mother on the second. In the course of these visits, I not only drank innumerable cups of tea and stayed to lunch once or twice, but also came to know a little more about Mrs. Sundup. Her name was not really Rose, she informed me simperingly. Rose was what she had been called at school on account of her beauty, and the name had stuck to her ever since. And indeed, though her black hair was now streaked with grey, though she had bad teeth, and though her pink cheeks were wrinkled like an old apple, the dumpy, bespectacled little woman in the shabby blue chuba and the faded and stained rainbow apron really did look as though she had once deserved her name. But if the flower itself had faded, its perfume lingered on. The perfume was charm. The fact was that despite her comparatively advanced years, Mrs. Sundup possessed charm to a truly extraordinary degree. Though perhaps it would be more correct to say not that she possessed charm, but that she emanated it. It emanated not only from the ingratiating manner and the winning smile, but from every coaxing, wheedling word she spoke, and every shy, shrinking, submissive, insinuating movement of her now somewhat corpulent person. Whether leaning her head to one side as she listened to what one was saying, or bending forward to offer one a toffee, or even asking one for the 5th or 6th time if one would mind coming again in a few days' time, Mrs. Sundup emanated charm from her very fingertips. It was in fact amazing that so much charm could coexist with so much scruffiness, both in her own person and in her immediate surroundings. This charm was not very much in evidence in the three members of her family who lived with her at Chung Building. Indeed, they did not resemble Mrs. Sundup in any way, and had one not known that they were, in fact, closely related to her, one would never have guessed. This was particularly true in the case of her son, a bright and intelligent-looking 12-year-old with typically Bengali features and complexion, who was evidently growing up very fast. "The Tibetan women have already started taking an interest in him," his mother informed me, with an air of great complacency, though the boy himself only scowled. In the case of her daughter, a thin, shy little girl of about 6, the features and complexion were not typically Bengali, but typically Chinese, and her lank black hair was cut straight across the forehead in Chinese fashion. Both son and daughter wore Western dress. Not so the third other member of the family. This was a stooping, lantern-jawed crone who shuffled around in a tubo that was even shabbier and a rainbow apron that was even more faded and stained than Mrs. Sundup's own, and she clearly had never possessed either beauty or charm at any stage of her career. From the fact that she seemed to be responsible for such cooking and cleaning as were carried on in the establishment, as well as from the fact that Mrs. Sundup spoke to her quite sharply at times, I concluded that the toothless old creature was a servant of some kind. But on my second or third visit to Chung Building, the supposed servant was introduced, with all Mrs. Sundup's usual charm, as her respected mother. Having been introduced, or rather identified, the respected mother stood grinning and bowing for a minute, and then shuffled back into the kitchen. Her 12-year-old son, her 6-year-old daughter, and her old mother were not the only members of Mrs. Sundup's family. As I learned some time later, she had 2 grown-up sons living in Darjeeling, but so deeply ashamed were they of their mother that they refused to have anything to do with her. These sons, who by all accounts were very decent young men, were Mrs. Sundup's sons by her first husband, a Sikkimese nobleman, who had divorced her after she had committed adultery with his Bengali lawyer. It was this Bengali lawyer who was the father of the 12-year-old son who lived with Mrs. Sundup at Chung Building. The 6-year-old daughter's father was a certain Mr. Chung of Calcutta, though Mr. Chung had denied this, and Mrs. Sundup had had to go to the kutcheri and swear to the fact of his paternity in order to get possession of Chung Building on behalf of her daughter. Since this had involved admitting in open court that she had had sexual relations with Mr. Chung while still married to another man, Mrs. Sundup had in effect publicly proclaimed herself a whore, a piece of brazenness for which she had been roundly condemned in Kalimpong. She was a shameless woman, and her morals were those of a barnyard. But Mrs. Sundup cared no more about what people thought of her morals than Mrs. Crisp cared what people thought of her shabby old dresses and her down-at-heel shoes. Like her good friend Rani Dorji, all Mrs. Sundup really cared about was money. Though the Sikkimese nobleman might have been the first of Mrs. Sundup's conquests, Mr. Chung of Calcutta had certainly not been the last. According to local report, Mrs. Sundup had been married, in one way or another, no fewer than 37 times. Strange to say, she had emerged from every one of these matrimonial adventures, the better off by a house or some valuable pieces of jewellery, or a substantial cash settlement. She was thus quite a rich woman, and all the more so because she never spent any money if she could help it, and never parted with anything she had acquired, except on terms highly advantageous to herself. Though only a Darjeeling-born Tibetan and the daughter of a Darjeeling-born Tibetan, her father had been a pork butcher, Mrs. Sundup had all the strong commercial instincts of her native Tibetan ancestors. Buying and selling were in her blood, so to speak, and she had the reputation of being an even better businesswoman than Rani Dorji. For whereas Rani Dorji was sometimes constrained by considerations of social prestige, Mrs. Sundup never was. Indeed, Mrs. Sundup had the reputation of being such a good businesswoman that she could cheat even the Mawaris, which in Kalimpong business circles was the ultimate accolade. Whether she managed to cheat the Mawaris by exclusively commercial means or whether she also employed some of her other skills, it was difficult to say. In any case, Mrs. Sundup handled all her complicated business and financial transactions herself and could often be seen hastening either up the high street in the direction of the bazaar or down it in the direction of the kutchery. On these occasions, she would be clad in the same shabby blue chuba and the same faded and stained rainbow apron that she wore indoors, though with the addition of a pair of men's black lace-up shoes. She always walked with her head bent forward, as though she was deep in thought, and with her rather large rump jutting out behind. Such was her reputation in the town that she was rarely accosted by anybody. Nepalese and Indians, though not Tibetans, often spat as she passed by. Indeed, it was said that the more orthodox among them held her in such abhorrence that if they happened to meet her first thing in the morning, when they were on their way to settle any matter of importance, they turned back and went home. The sight of an immoral woman, especially a woman as immoral as Mrs. Sundup, was an inauspicious omen and brought bad luck for the rest of the day. But long before I learned all these things, I had stopped visiting Chung Building, or at least stopped visiting the flat on the third floor. After I'd been there 7 or 8 times and had been asked 7 or 8 times if I wouldn't mind coming back again in 2 or 3 days' time, Miss Rao happened to mention that when she had gone upstairs the previous day to pay the month's rent, Mrs. Sundup had spoken to her about me. "That English monk keeps coming to see me," she had tittered, no doubt with her usual charm. "I'm sure I don't know what he wants." Realizing that the distinguished devotee and staunch supporter of the Mahabodhi Society was trying to spin some kind of web around me, and that she was not really interested in helping me bring out the Nepali Dhammapada in book form, I stopped going to see her and started looking for help elsewhere. I was still doing this, not very successfully, when Gayan Jyoti came and told me he had finished writing up the accounts of the Sacred Relics Reception Committee, and that there was a surplus of nearly 2,000 rupees. What were we to do with the money? It did not take me long to call a meeting of the committee and to propose that the amount should be donated to the YMBA for the purpose of bringing out a Nepali translation of the Dhammapada. Nor did it take the committee long to agree to my proposal. A few months later, therefore, the translation of the Dhammapada made its appearance in book form, and Nepali-speaking Buddhists were at last able to study the whole of this celebrated scripture in their own language. In the meantime, however, Mrs. Sundup had sent me a bundle of grubby currency notes and a few lines scribbled in pencil on a scrap of paper torn from a school exercise book. "Here is 50 rupees for your Nepali Dhammapada," she wrote. "I am sure the printers will do the work for this amount if you bargain with them a little." End of chapter 12.